From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and senators are making their way back into a hearing room where earlier today, Christine Blasey Ford, the woman accusing Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her, gave her testimony to the Senate Judiciary Committee. She told senators she was positive that it was Brett Kavanaugh who forced her onto a bed, held her down, groped her, covered her mouth to stifle her screams at a high school gathering in 1982. Here's the Democrat, Dick Durbin, and then Ford.
Dr. Ford, with what degree of certainty do you believe Brett Kavanaugh assaulted you?
100%.
Well, we are waiting now for Brett Kavanaugh to begin his testimony. It could happen at any moment now. And he, of course, is going to deny the accusations, as he has been. In fact, he is walking into the hearing room right now. NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell has been watching. Kelsey, what's the feeling there? What's the sense that you're getting from Republican lawmakers coming out of Ford's testimony?
The majority of Republicans who were speaking to reporters after this hearing said that they found Ford to be credible. People said that they were moved by her testimony, that she seemed raw, she seemed real, and she seemed as if she was speaking honestly about an event that had a very major impact on her life. Though many Republicans also said that there's no way to corroborate her story or to verify that it was, in fact, Kavanaugh and not maybe somebody else. That's been the line that they've repeated often here, is that there's a possibility. They've been raising the possibility that maybe it was somebody else. Maybe she's mistaken.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to some of the story that she told of being pushed into a bedroom. She says she was at a gathering. She was aware of maybe six people, just kind of an after diving practice gathering, not really a party, she said. And she'd gone upstairs to use the bathroom when she was pushed from behind into a room, then locked in that room with Brett Kavanaugh and his friend Mark Judge, and Kavanaugh held her down on a bed.
I tried to yell for help. When I did, Brett put his hand over my mouth to stop me from yelling. This is what terrified me the most and has had the most lasting impact on my life. It was hard for me to breathe, and I thought that Brett was accidentally going to kill me.
It was an incredibly powerful moment there. But, Brett Kavanaugh, what are people anticipating he will say?
Well, we have heard what Kavanaugh has had to say over many statements released by the White House and his own appearance on Fox News. So his denial is well-established fact, something that I've talked to many, many people about here in this building at NPR and also people on Capitol Hill, is that his story is familiar now to people, whereas Ford was unknown. And people walked in not even really knowing what she looked like. So she had a different kind of impact than he will be able to have here, again, because there are a limited number of questions that senators are going to be able to have if the answer is, it wasn't me.
No, that's true. How many times can you ask someone that? And there's going to be an interesting thing happen, an interesting switch here, because in order to question Ford, a woman, the all-male Republican part of the panel brought in Arizona sex crimes prosecutor Rachel Mitchell to ask questions for them, kind of, I don't know, implying that maybe they didn't know how to speak to this woman. They said that they were trying to satisfy people who were asking for a woman to be involved. Here she is speaking on behalf of Senator John Cornyn, taking his time, asking about what she saw as inconsistencies in Ford's account of when the alleged assault occurred.
How were you able to narrow down the time frame?
I can't give the exact date, and I would like to be more helpful about the date, and if I knew when Mark Judge worked at the Potomac Safeway, then I would be able to be more helpful in that way.
And this is something that she said many times in her testimony, that she bumped into Mark Judge, Brett Kavanaugh's friend, at a Potomac Safeway. And that was just, it came out of nowhere, but you feel now that people are going to be frantically looking through records there to see when Mark Judge worked there. But now the Republican senators themselves are going to be asking questions of the man.
That's not necessarily true, actually, and we don't believe that to be true. We don't believe that Republican senators will be asking questions. We believe that that Mitchell will again ask questions on their behalf.
Oh, okay. Well, that's something we hadn't yet heard. But what signal does that send that they're not asking their own questions?
Well, Republicans told me throughout the week that they believed this to be a tremendously complicated issue, and one where they felt that somebody who is more well-equipped to understand the complexities of sexual assault and sexually related crimes could get better answers, essentially, could elicit more comprehensive answers from somebody who is coming to them as an avowed victim.
Yeah. And Kelsey Snow, one last question. We have a few seconds here. Has the White House said anything about the testimony so far?
We have not seen any releases from the White House so far. We know that the president said that he planned to watch, and perhaps we will hear from them later.
Yeah. Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional reporter. Thanks so much, Kelsey, for being with us on this day.
Of course.
Okay, let's bring in Bill Press. He's a Democrat and host of The Bill Press Show. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Hey, Peter. Good. Good to be here.
All right, good to have you. And Alice Stewart, a Republican strategist. Alice, it's nice to have you.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Sure. And let's start with you, because Brett Kavanaugh is now, his opening statements have started. He is speaking to senators. What will he need to do in the next few hours over the course of this part of the hearing to salvage his nomination?
He will need to do what she did, is appear credible and appear that he has nothing to hide and be forthcoming and tell all. And I'm one in the communications business. I think optics are everything. And just judging on her demeanor in preparation as she walked into the room compared to him as he just walked out in his demeanor walking in, the way I view it, she looked terrified. Mm-hmm. He looks like he's ready to go to war. Mm-hmm. So I think that says a lot about what we can expect from him. We do know, having seen his opening statements, he will yet again categorically deny what is being charged with and reinforce his credentials as a judge to be on the Supreme Court and stress that sexual assault is horrific and morally wrong, and he did nothing wrong here.
Bill, speaking of going to war, the president has made it very clear that he wants Judge Kavanaugh to be more indignant, more combative compared to the way that he performed in that Fox News interview. Do you think that that's a wise way to come to the table?
No, in a word. I don't think the American public want to see a tiny Trump in Brett Kavanaugh. I think they want to see someone who is certainly very determined in his story and very certain of his story. But not one who is combative and not one who is insulting and not one demeaning to women or to his accuser, but just someone that they can believe to tell the truth. I think it's a hard act to follow for mm-hmm. Brett Kavanaugh this afternoon. And one of the things is which he can't do anything about. There's no way that he can come across, I believe, as just someone who is real, who is genuine, who is as terrified, if you will, as Christine Ford. You know, it's who he is. He is a professional, polished, accomplished attorney and a creature of the Washington swamp, and that's what he looks like.
Alice, on the issue of tone, after the first part of this hearing wrapped up, Republican Lindsey Graham went outside the hearing room. He spoke with reporters, and he said that he felt ambushed by Democrats that are trying to take down Kavanaugh. Let's listen.
When it comes to where it happened, I still don't know. I don't know when it happened. She said she's 100% certain it did happen. I bet you Judge Kavanaugh will say I'm 100% sure I didn't do it. The people named say they don't know what Ms. Ford's talking about. She can't tell us how she got home and how she got there. And thus, the facts I'm left with. A nice lady who has come forward to tell a hard story that's uncorroborated, and this is enough. God help anybody else that gets nominated.
Alice, your thoughts. Do those details that Senator Graham was going after, focusing on, how important are they really?
They are important. It would be nice to have videotape of every crime that ever goes before a Senate committee. That's just not possible. And it is not uncommon, based on all the information we've heard, that victims of sexual assault remember specific things, and certain things are blocked out of her memory. You heard her say she cannot get the uproarious laughter of the two men out of her head. She cannot forget the bedroom and the stairs and the living room. There's certain things she can remember, but certain things she can't. And I think it's easy to focus on what she cannot remember, but we also have to take into consideration what she does. At the same time, I agree with a lot of what Senator Graham is saying. If we take uncooperated, unsubstantiated stories from 36 years ago to take down someone, in my view, who is extremely qualified to sit on the Supreme Court, then I think it sets a precedent for a lot of folks that will never run for office ever again and will never try to be on the Supreme Court if we're going to undress everything they did in high school.
Peter, let me add, if I can, that there are these questions, but I thought that one of the ways that Christine Ford showed that she's really genuine and for real when she said, you know, I honestly cannot remember certain parts of this, but if the FBI, if they questioned me, if they talked to these other witnesses, if they went to find out, she kept talking about when Mark Judge was working at the Potomac Safeway, it would help me nail down the timing of the event. I still think it's hard for the Republicans to defend not allowing time for the FBI to investigate and talk to all the people who have been named and not to call Mark Judge in as a witness.
That's Bill Press, a Democrat who's also the host of the Bill Press Show, and Alice Stewart, the Republican strategist. Stay in your seats because we're gonna have you back. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Peter.
All right, got it.
We're following the dramatic Senate hearing in Washington today, which will shape the future of the Supreme Court. But we also want to take a moment now to catch up on some of the highlights from another big story this week, the United Nations General Assembly. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres started the week off in New York by diagnosing the world with something he called trust deficit disorder, and he delivered a warning about technology.
At United Nations, we are harnessing technologies in support of the Sustainable Development Goals. We are creating innovation labs, including in my office. And in July, I established a high-level panel on digital cooperation that met yesterday, and that is a dialogue platform for all key actors. Excellencies, the impacts of new technologies on warfare are a direct threat to our common responsibility to guarantee peace and security. The weaponization of artificial intelligence is a growing concern. The prospect of weapons that can select and attack a target on their own raises multiple alarms and could trigger new arms races. Diminished oversight of weapons has implications for our efforts to contain threats, to prevent escalation, and to adhere to international humanitarian and human rights law. And let's call it as it is. The prospect of machines with the discretion and power to take human life is morally repugnant.
During his remarks to the assembly, President Trump reiterated his America First foreign policy and disavowed what he called the ideology of globalism.
Each of us here today is the emissary of a distinct culture, a rich history, and a people bound together by ties of memory, tradition, and the values that make our homelands like nowhere else on earth. That is why America will always choose independence and cooperation over global governance, control, and domination.
French President Emmanuel Macron fired back at Trump in his own speech just a few minutes later.
Je l'affirme ici.
This doctrine is one of unilateralism.
De l'unilatéralisme.
It leads directly to isolationism and to conflict.
He then pleaded to the nations assembled.
Vous habituez pas.
Please, do not get used to it. Don't become indifferent. Do not accept the erosion of multilateralism. Do not accept our history unraveling. I am not getting used to this.
Nevertheless, Trump promised to respect all countries in his opening speech to the General Assembly.
I honor the right of every nation in this room to pursue its own customs, beliefs, and traditions. The United States will not tell you how to live or work or worship. We only ask that you honor our sovereignty in return.
But some world leaders were not buying it. Here's Bolivian President Evo Morales speaking through a translator.
Each time that the United States invades nations, launches missiles, or finances regime change, it does so behind a propaganda campaign, which incessantly repeats the message that it is acting in the cause of justice, freedom, and democracy, in the cause of human rights or for humanitarian reasons. I would like to say to you frankly and openly here, in no way is the United States interested in upholding democracy. If such were the case, it would not have financed coup d'etat and supported dictators. It would not have threatened with military intervention democratically elected governments, as it has done with Venezuela. The United States could not care less about human rights nor justice. If this were the case, it would have signed the international conventions and treaties for the protection of human rights. It would not have threatened the investigation mechanisms of the International Criminal Court, nor would it promote the use of torture. Nor would it have walked away from the Human Rights Council, and nor would it have separated migrant children from their families, nor put them in cages.
Interference was a theme of the week. Trump announced this new claim during his meeting with the UN Security Council.
In my remarks yesterday to the United Nations General Assembly, I laid out my administration's commitment to building a more just and peaceful future. Regrettably, we found that China has been attempting to interfere in our upcoming 2018 election, coming up in November, against my administration. They do not want me or us to win because I am the first president ever to challenge China on trade. And we are winning on trade. We are winning at every level. We don't want them to meddle or interfere in our upcoming election.
Trump did not mention Russian interference in the U.S. election, but he did address the issue of Iran.
The Iranian regime exports violence, terror, and turmoil. It illicitly procures sensitive items to advance its ballistic missile program and proliferates these missiles all across the Middle East. The regime is the world's leading sponsor of terror and fuels conflict across the region and far beyond. A regime with this track record must never be allowed to possess a nuclear weapon. For this reason, I announced earlier this year that the United States would withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. This horrible one-sided deal allowed Iran to continue its path towards a bomb and gave the regime a cash lifeline when they needed it the most. They were in big, big trouble. They needed cash. We gave it to them.
It was a reference to the Iran nuclear deal that the United Nations adopted in 2015. President Trump pulled the U.S. out of that deal to the pleasure of U.S. allies Saudi Arabia and Israel. And here's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after a private meeting with Trump.
Mr. President Donald, thank you. And this is a manifold thank you. First, thank you for your strong words yesterday in the General Assembly. Against the corrupt terrorist regime in Iran. You back up your strong words and strong actions. And I think the fact that you have brought American sanctions to bear has cut the cash machine of Iran and its campaign of carnage and conquest in the Middle East. And we who live in the Middle East, Israelis and Arabs, who are subject to this Iranian danger, want to thank you especially. Secondly, I want to thank you for the extraordinary support that you have shown for Israel in this building, in the UN. No one has backed Israel like you do, and we appreciate it. Third, this is the first time that we meet after the American embassy has been moved to Jerusalem.
That's right.
You've changed history, and you've touched our hearts. And fourth and last, I want to say how much I appreciate your robust defense of Israel's right of self-defense, which you've just expressed. I think everybody should understand that Israel will continue to do what is necessary to defend ourselves against Iranian aggression in Syria, in Lebanon, anywhere else. And I want to say also that we have no doubt that as we do so, we'll enjoy the support of President Donald Trump and the United States of America. I think, and I say this objectively, that the American-Israeli alliance has never been stronger, stronger than ever before under your leadership. And I look forward to working with you and your team to advance our common interests, security, prosperity, and peace with Israel's neighbors and for the region. And we can do it with you.
But the previous day, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani had this to say through a translator.
It is unfortunate that we are witnessing rulers in the world who think they can secure their interests better, or at least in the short term ride public sentiments and gain popular support through the fomenting of extremist nationalism and racism, and through xenophobic tendencies resembling a Nazi disposition, as well as through the trampling of global rules and undermining international institutions, even through preposterous and abnormal acts such as convening a high-level meeting of the Security Council. This illusion should be cast away once and for all, that one can aspire to securing more peace and security at the cost of denying others peace and security. We should not allow the breathing space for and growth of the line of thinking that holds others to ransom through the artificial creation of insecurity. Along this track, confronting multilateralism is not a sign of strength. Rather, it is a symptom of the weakness of intellect. It betrays an inability in understanding a complex and interconnected world.
And embattled Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro made a surprise visit after President Trump indicated all options are on the table to counter the Venezuelan leader, including the strong ones.
Venezuela has been subjected to economic sanctions. These are illegal unilateral sanctions imposed on us. The U.S. president yesterday in this very room spoke of new sanctions, what they call economic and financial sanctions against our country. It's illegal from the standpoint of international law.
Some excerpts from speeches by world leaders at the United Nations General Assembly earlier this week.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The price of crude oil hit a four-year high this week at $82 a barrel, and some economists say it could top $100 by January. The rebound comes as the U.S. pursues sanctions against Iran, which produces a lot of oil, and as Venezuelan production slumps because of that country's economic crisis. Joining us now is Robin Farzad. He hosts the podcast Full Disclosure. Robin, welcome back.
Peter, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. A lot of geopolitical uncertainty with some very big oil-producing countries. Is that what's driving this price of oil up right now?
Well, on the flip side of that, the United States here, you guys talk about the economy every day. We are booming and thirsty with unemployment low, consumer spending high. It seems like every new car on the road is a crossover, an SUV. So we're still the most pivotal consumer of hydrocarbons on the planet. And you also talked about us putting the screws to Iran. And traders, they're scrambling to figure out how the system can, you know, compensate for Iran having to slash exports in the new sanctions regime.
Oil-producing countries of OPEC recently met in Algeria, where members said they did not want to increase the supply. And here's what President Trump said about OPEC at the UN General Assembly meeting earlier this week.
OPEC and OPEC nations are, as usual, ripping off the rest of the world. And I don't like it. Nobody should like it.
Robin, Trump has said that OPEC should lower prices, but, you know, why would these oil-producing countries have any incentive to do that?
OPEC, you know, is just not a monolith. One of the stats that I love is that North Dakota in the United States now produces more oil than until recently the smallest member of OPEC, Ecuador.
Wow.
But you look at the likes of Iran and Venezuela, they desperately need higher oil prices just to make ends meet. Saudi Arabia, on the other hand, you know, wouldn't mind seeing Iran struggle in the wind a little. And the same thing applies to the young producers in the United States, the shale patch, and even Canada. Their cost of extracting, while it's less than it was a decade ago, it's still high. So as oil approaches $100, that's essential to them, and that is going to worry Saudi Arabia.
You brought up North Dakota and the other U.S. shale producers. Let's talk about that for a minute, because that supply, putting that supply onto the market, did help keep prices kind of low for a while. So what's happening with that supply? Are we still getting as much shale oil as we used to?
Well, the controversy is Iran, are we taking off 500,000 barrels a day up to 2 million barrels? And North Dakota and the shale patch, it's still labor intensive, and all the roughnecks and engineers are in short supply. So just go check out hiring right now in North Dakota. The higher labor costs mean a higher cost of getting that next barrel out of the ground. So these are tight times.
You got to work hard to get it. Look, $100 a barrel, it's like this symbolic threshold that we are kind of fascinated with for some reason. But what does it mean from a practical level? Like $100 a barrel means what for the economy?
Well, you know, they inevitably, these are going to drive costs higher. There's only so much you can absorb as a trucking company or UPS or even Uber Eats driver before, you know, passing it on to everyone from manufacturers, farms, consumers. But as we know from 2008, that sows the seeds of its own destruction. You recall how much behaviors changed when we visited $4 a gallon for gasoline.
Robin Farzad, host of the podcast Full Disclosure. Thanks very much, Robin.
My pleasure. My pleasure, good sir.
In emotional testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Brett Kavanaugh says the Supreme Court confirmation process is a national disgrace.
This whole two-week effort has been a calculated and orchestrated political hit, fueled with apparent pent-up anger about President Trump and the 2016 election.
Professor Christine Blasey Ford started off the day with emotional testimony of her own, outlining accusations of sexual assault by Kavanaugh when they were in high school in the 1980s. Kavanaugh, in his testimony, categorically denied those allegations. Let's bring in Alice Stewart. She's a Republican strategist. Alice, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here. Thank you, Peter.
And Bill Press, a Democrat and host of The Bill Press Show. Bill, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Peter.
Okay, Alice, let's start with you. Remarkable from the very first moments of Kavanaugh's testimony. Here he is talking about how the accusations have impacted his family.
The other night, Ashley and my daughter Liza said their prayers. And little Liza, all of 10 years old, said to Ashley, "We should pray for the woman." It's a lot of wisdom from a 10-year-old. We mean no ill will.
Alice, what do you make of that moment? I think when we spoke last time, you said he needed to look human. He certainly does here.
Absolutely, without a doubt. And two times that we've seen him so far choke up and become tearful and in essence cry was when he talked about his family and how the impact this has had so far on his daughters and his wife. And then when he spoke about his father and his father's keeping of calendars and documents and diaries throughout his life and how that has impacted him. He clearly is someone that is emotional about this. His credibility is on the line. His future is on the line. But in more than anything, what we're seeing is the emotional way he is trying to convey his innocence, his own credibility, and the fact that he is trying to also show that, look, she may be telling the truth. She may have been assaulted, and this may very well have happened to her, but it wasn't me. I was not the person who did that.
Bill, we thought that Kavanaugh would come out swinging. he certainly did that, too, which is interesting because this has been a mix of both aggression that I think some of his supporters were looking for, but also this emotional side that we just heard. What do you think about the first few moments of his testimony?
Well, it is interesting, just when we talked about a half an hour ago, you ask,
whether he might come out, you know, a la Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. He certainly did. We also know that the president was very disappointed. He felt that Brett Kavanaugh had been too nice so far. Chuck Grassley had been too nice, and they really had to be tougher. And I think Donald Trump could have written his opening lines. I mean, he called it a calculated political hit. He called it a circus, a grotesque character association. He warned the Democrats, what comes around goes around. I mean, he did everything but call it a witch hunt, which maybe Donald Trump, you know, was waiting for. I think it might have been a little over the top. He was red in the face, and I'm not sure compared to, again, he had a tough act to follow, the sort of very human nature that was side that we saw of Christine Blasey Ford, that this is what the American people wanted to see. You expected him to deny, which he did. You expect him to affirm his innocence and to say, I'm ready for the Supreme Court, I'm the one I ought to be there, which he did. But I think the attitude might have turned some people off.
Well, there's a lot more to come. This is, again, just he hasn't even taken questions yet from senators. So it'll be very important to see how the Republicans treat him and also, of course, how the Democrats treat him. But at the end of the day, what are we to do with what we're hearing throughout the many hours of this testimony? Because Ford testifies under oath that she's 100% sure it was Kavanaugh. He testifies under oath that he categorically did not do it. Alice, how are we going to get to the bottom of this by tomorrow when the committee is supposed to vote?
They're clearly going to base their decision on their relationship with Judge Kavanaugh, and they're all, and those Republicans will do so. And Democrats, in my view, based on what we've heard from some of them, the senator from Hawaii has already said that he doesn't deserve the presumption of innocence, and he is guilty regardless of what they hear. So I think Democrats are going to vote against him no matter what, and Republicans, for the most part, will vote for him. But keep
in mind—
Do you
think a vote should happen tomorrow?
I do. I think they should move forward with this. This is certainly—it's not a trial. This is the nomination process. This is not based on evidence, but rather emotion. We have no new evidence brought into this. It is clearly based on the emotion that Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh are presenting, their credibility, and what we've seen so far. She comes across as someone who is credible. She is a compelling witness in her own defense. But you can say the exact same about Judge Kavanaugh. And he is someone, as I said, with a lifetime of the utmost character and integrity. And it will just boil down to what the senators believe in their heart, in their gut, because there's not going to be concrete evidence to sway them one way or the other.
You mentioned how some of the Democrats had responded. I want to go through some of the Republican response to this, too. After the Ford portion of the hearing, Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin said, I think she believes what she is saying, not implying that, you know, he wasn't going to go that far. Senator John Cornyn said, it's exactly what I expected. It's basically repeating what we've already been told. And then Senator Graham, Lindsey Graham, of course, had some very he was worked up. And he said, if this is the new norm, you better watch out for your nominees. But Bill, this testimony may not change the calculation for the those Republicans. What really matters is, are Republicans like Jeff Flake?
Absolutely.
So what are you what are you watching for there?
Well, I was just going to mention, agree with Alice. I think that both of us would agree that the votes on this committee are well known. They could have voted yesterday. If they vote tomorrow, the vote would be the same. Lindsey Graham said, I don't care what she says tomorrow. I'm going to vote for Brett Kavanaugh. So I think the real chemistry here is not with the members of the Judiciary Committee. It's Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Jeff Flake, and maybe Ben Sasse. I think it will be very difficult for those, if you will, undecided Republicans to hear and listen Christine Blasey Ford and then be rushed to vote for Brett Kavanaugh. I think the Republicans would be smart to slow it down, take some time, maybe bring in the FBI, talk to Mark Judge. You know, Brett Kavanaugh said, I never met Christine Ford. Christine Ford said, I went to several parties where Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh were both there. Who could answer that question? If anybody could, Mark Judge could, but the committee won't even hear him.
Okay, Alice, I want to go back to that this portion about Jeff Flake and some of the other Republicans. What are you thinking is going on in their head right now? And are you concerned at all that they may change their mind coming out of today?
I think they're very wise, given the fact that they have been a little indecisive on where they want to go, to keep it close to the vest until this is all done. All of them, in my view, are being irresponsible to go ahead and say where they're going to vote when we haven't heard from both sides. So Jeff Flake and others that Bill had mentioned, Collins and Murkowski and Sass as well, they should wait until the final word is spoken and then make their judgments known. I do believe, especially if any of these Republicans plan to run for president in 2020, Flake being the main one, they will face a difficult time getting any conservative to support them if they vote against Judge Kavanaugh.
They have difficulty getting women to support them if they vote for him.
Yeah, no, it's a complicated calculation that both sides are playing here. We just have a couple minutes left. I was thinking as I was watching the Kavanaugh side of this testimony, I was just wondering, not that it matters, what President Trump would be thinking. You know, he's watching this, and this was a very emotional testimony by Kavanaugh. Just quickly, Alice, and then Bill, if you could weigh in, what do you think how the president will respond?
He will say, as he's been saying, is that this did not happen. Judge Kavanaugh is innocent, and this was all smear campaign by the Democrats, and let's put this to a vote today.
Bill, last word.
I think Donald Trump can't wait to give him a high five and say, "You're my man. You're just like me."
Bill Press and Alice Stewart, thanks to you both. Appreciate it.
Thanks, okay. Peter.
President Trump is back at the White House after wrapping up business at the UN General Assembly meeting in New York this week. He said yesterday in that extraordinary press conference at the UN that he was looking forward to watching the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and the first woman to accuse him of sexual assault, Christine Blasey Ford. Here's what the president might have heard of Ford in her opening statement.
It is not my responsibility to determine whether Mr. Kavanaugh deserves to sit on the Supreme Court. My responsibility is to tell you the truth.
In his rambling press conference last night, Trump defended Brett Kavanaugh, also talked about similar allegations against him.
I was accused by four or five women who got paid a lot of money to make up stories about me. We caught them. And the mainstream media refused to put it on television. They refused to even write about it.
And the president ultimately admitted to a reporter yesterday that his own experience being accused by women was shading his view of Kavanaugh. It was an extraordinary moment, one of many. Bahman Kalbasi is the BBC Persian U.S. correspondent. That means he reaches millions of Farsi or Persian speakers, mainly in Iran. And he joins us from right outside the U.N. Bahman, first of all, what did you make of the press conference?
Well, we have come to watch press conferences by President Trump that have been described as unconventional and unlike anything traditional politicians put on when they meet media representatives. But even within that expectation, that lower bar, I think yesterday was extraordinary in so many ways, mainly when it came to foreign issues. The things that he said about talking to Iran, or the sentence that he had about how China was a very big fan of his very, very big brain. That kind of talk created a lot of reaction in our audience as well, not just the Americans who were watching it.
Well, especially since he had also at the UN accused China of interfering in U.S. elections.
The Chinese foreign minister was kind of taken aback. The cameras were on him and he kind of shrugged it off, but he displayed a visual reaction to it because I think he wasn't expecting it at all. Mm. You know, the way he's treating the world leaders here at the UN is quite different from any other president that I've ever seen.
Well, the cameras caught a lot of reactions. There were the German delegates kind of laughing when the president was scolding them for having any relations with Russia over, you know, energy. There was that moment where the entire room seemed to laugh when the president kind of switched to campaign mode and was talking about the achievements of his administration. He says the UN General Assembly audience was laughing with him, not at him. It just, of course, did not look that way. Then there were also people who spoke directly to him. He chaired the Security Council, And members of the council have criticized President Trump's decision to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. Here's British Prime Minister Theresa May speaking about just that at that Security Council meeting.
It remains the best means of preventing Iran developing a nuclear weapon, and we are committed to preserving the JCPOA as long as Iran continues to abide by its obligations in full.
What is the thinking of the future of the Iran nuclear deal without U.S. participation and with the U.S. continuing to level sanctions against Tehran and other countries maybe doing business with Tehran?
It's quite a moment to watch the President of the United States sit there and not only say that we are violating a deal that was enshrined in a U.N. Security Council resolution 2231, but are telling the other members of the U.N. Security Council that they should violate a U.N. Security Council resolution. Mm-hmm. If they don't, as he threatened, they will be punished. But there is an economic reality, and that economic reality is, despite the opposition to the president, the tools in Washington to put pressure on all these companies are still very strong, and the consequence of it is already clear. Iran's currency is crashing, basically impoverishing a whole nation of 80 million because the president of the United States has decided that is politically beneficial to him domestically.
On the other hand, I just want to ask you one quick thing about North Korea, because there were world leaders who were praising President Trump for the diplomacy with North Korea that's happened since a year ago when he used the pulpit there to bully North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, calling him Rocket Man. Do you think that there's a sense among the world leaders that maybe that can happen again with Iran, that the president is bullying them now, but he may feel like he's having the last laugh if he actually gets some kind of agreement?
No, because the message is being sent to the world is this. If you have a bomb, if you possess a nuclear weapon, you will be treated with much more respect by this president than if you don't. In the case of Iran, it doesn't have a nuclear bomb. It actually has allowed one of the most intrusive inspection regime to prevent it from ever having a bomb, and it's being sanctioned. So the message it's sending to Iran is, in fact, if you had a bomb, I would be treating you a lot differently.
Lahman Kalbasi, BBC Persian U.S. correspondent, meaning that he broadcasts largely to Farsi-speaking Iranians, or Persian-speaking Iranians. Bachman, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And what an incredible week.
No kidding.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.